Thank you, folks. We will now hear the 10:15 time certain.
Item 259, extend the effective date of a comprehensive plan map and zoning map amendment previously approved by ordinance numbers 180713, 180749, and 181175 for property located at 8528 North Van Houten Place at the request of the University of Portland and Triangle Park LLC, LU06132925 CPZC.
Media staff.
Thank you, Mayor Potter, council members. Douglas Hardy with the Bureau of Development Services. The matter before you is, for the most part, a bookkeeping item. Roughly a year ago, council adopted a ordinance that approved a comprehensive plan map and zoning map amendment for what's known as the Triangle Park site that sits at the base of the bluff below the University of Portland campus. That comp plan zone map amendment rezoned the property from an industrial zone to an employment zone, which would allow the university to do development on that site at a future date if approved through a conditional use plan. And basically what the ordinance contained language that basically said that unless the university acquires the property by the effective date of the ordinance, that basically the university and the property owner would have to come back to council to request to extend the effective date of that comprehensive plan map amendment. The applicant, University of Portland, has not yet acquired the property. They are still negotiating with the current property owner. And basically, today they are requesting that the effective date of that comprehensive plan map and zoning map amendment be extended from March 1st, 2008 to September 1st, 2008.
Questions from the commissioners? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Did anyone sign up to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
An emergency vote. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Well, I'm going to enthusiastically support this extension, not only because I'm sure we all in the City Council are committed to the success and growth of the University of Portland, but given their vision for providing new park and recreation community benefits as part of their expansion, as a resident of North Portland, this is the single best opportunity North Portland has had to add natural space, access to the riverbank, and parks and recreational opportunities. So to the University of Portland and the folks that you're negotiating with, keep at it. We want you to succeed. Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Sten.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye.
Thank you.
Please read the 10:30 time certain.
Item 260, amend and clarify provisions of the Campaign Finance Fund.
Auditor Blackmer.
Mr. Mayor, if I could, a point of personal privilege. I'm going to recuse myself from considering this particular item because I am in a contested race for mayor. And my suggestion is to have the hearing but move over the vote until next week when there'll be a different fourth person here who doesn't have a strongly contested race. So I'm going to get out of here for a few minutes.
Mayor, members of council, Gary Blackmer, Portland City Auditor. We brought to council changes in the code last spring, and during that discussion, Commissioner Saltzman pointed out an area that he thought and we agreed needed more work, which was how to address independent expenditures. The intent of public campaign financing is to try to provide some kind of a level playing field while limiting campaign funds that participating candidates get, but still giving them the opportunity to request matching funds in certain circumstances. On the other side of it, if an independent group, a political action committee, provides independent expenditures to support a participating candidate, that created an inequity for those candidates who don't participate in our system. So we sat down with the Citizen Campaign Commission through the summer and started developing kind of a strategy for developing a mechanism to provide for kind of an incremental adjustments in circumstances where independent expenditures occur. We haven't had any at the local level during a campaign season in the past, but it's happening more at the national, state level, and so this is an area that the commission agreed needed work on. We would have had this here a month earlier, but we had to scramble and deal with a special election, so that put their schedule off by a month.
Sorry about that.
We did produce a report, and I do apologize. In putting it together, in our haste, we could have provided, I think, a better clarification for what the specific changes are in normal language. The methodology that the group went through was to develop a number of scenarios for different independent expenditure situations. And out of that came some principles and strategies for doing it that we translated into code. But it's a little difficult to leap from the scenarios to the code. So what I put together this morning is kind of a brief synopsis of the things that this code provides. And I'll go through those rather quickly with you. But let me have Carla pass these out to you. The approach that the commission took was to define a threshold, which was the amount at the beginning of what a candidate would receive if they were publicly financed. So for purposes of discussion, that would be $150,000 for a commissioner. And that threshold would be there until some outside element would result in a change to it, a raising of that threshold. And there would, in these code changes, if an independent group, a political action committee, were to spend, say, $10,000 in support of a publicly financed candidate, what happens is the threshold gets raised by $10,000. That means that a non-participating candidate can raise another $10,000 without triggering matching funds for that participating candidate. So in essence, that participating candidate has the $150,000 that they're eligible for, and they've received some benefit from that $10,000 of independent expenditures. This would allow the non-participating candidate to raise another $10,000 without triggering matching. So that's, in essence, how it works in both ways. If a independent expenditure benefits a non-participating candidate, then matching funds would be available to the participants in our system. So it's a means of allowing a leveling of the playing field when these occasions arise. And what the scenarios were we talked about were we looked at different combinations of numbers of candidates and how that would work, different combinations of independent expenditures sequentially. If there's an independent expenditure that a flyer that has four candidates on it, how do we apportion out the benefit for our one participating candidate if it's got, say, other races involved in the flyer that's going out? And so what we did was we used the general intent that we wanted to keep it as level as possible in terms of the playing field during this, but also recognizing that we're in the midst of a campaign season. We need to make decisions relatively rapidly. We did allow for an appeal process. If a candidate feels like a decision was made that didn't meet what they thought was a fair result, they can appeal to my office and we'll confer with the Citizen Campaign Commission on whether they want to revise or discuss in any way the decision that was made. They also have the ability to appeal to the courts if, for some reason, they feel like that still wasn't satisfactory. There may be occasions when we don't anticipate some, more intriguing kind of independent expenditure, or it's in a gray area whether it really is a benefit or not. And this allows me to confer with the Citizen Campaign Commission in those circumstances. And also, if we see a situation that we see a ready remedy for, we can make a decision on that, even if it's not addressed in the code, put some rules together that ultimately those will be brought back to council in the biennial reports that the Citizen Campaign Commission prepares on adjustments to the code. One other change that they recommended was, in the past we had said that that total pool of matching funds available that's divided among candidates for matching was up to 200% of the amount of that threshold amount. For example, the $150,000 for candidates is the primary amount, and we have a threshold of 100% additional funds that are available to be divided out for matching. In the general, however, we had raised that to 200%. So the commissioner in a general race is eligible for $200,000 in matching funds. That would allow another $200,000 in campaign funds. This would allow another $400,000 of potential matching for that candidate. The commission looked at that and thought $150,000 would be a more reasonable number than $200,000. So they scaled back the general matching amount for those elections by roughly $50,000 for commissioners. And mayor race is $250,000. Instead of being an additional $500,000, it would be an additional $375,000. So it's a little bit of savings. The sense that the commission had in looking at the spending that's been going on in the races is that that may not be necessary, especially since there would only be one candidate that would be eligible for those funds. And keep in mind, candidates don't have to ask for all that money, but if they wanted it, they would be eligible for it. And this results in a little bit of a savings to the city in terms of what would be possible to be distributed. Lastly, there were just some Scrivener corrections that we made in this version of the code. There are references to Oregon statutes that had changed the numbering, and we did some consistency in the naming of the some of the entities and elements. So what you see before you is the result of the commission's report. I should say what I distributed to you last week, I noticed some errors in the commission report that we had not caught. There are some typos and some editorial changes, and we got to your office a new version of the report, which is accompanies this ordinance, and so I would ask you to accept the amended report as part of your consideration today.
Questions?
Well, I just want to clarify something here. I don't think I'm on. On each of these, it basically says, if there's a dispute, it sets out the new rules, but if there's a dispute, you'll make the call and the candidate has the right to confer with the Citizens Commission. Does that mean the Citizens Commission can overrule you?
Well, I would.
I'm worried about that being a little vague.
Well,
because I we do know that one thing is certain, that candidates will both purposely and inadvertently hit spots right in between these rules, and opponents will appeal. So I'm worried about the confer language.
Well,
what that means.
I think what I would like to do is use the Citizen Campaign Commission as a sounding board, and it's likely it wouldn't be the whole commission, just because many of these decisions need to be made relatively quickly. So we would ask the commission to appoint a subcommittee that could be assembled and, you know, at a moment's notice to sit down with me. Look at the issue that's brought forward and advise me on it. But ultimately, it has to be one person that makes the decision, and I don't think we can get the commission to assemble and in a timely way to conduct an appeal. So in these matters, it is going to have to come down to one person making a decision.
So that's clear in the code that it's your decision.
That's correct.
You're just, okay, because I think, I mean, mm-hmm.
Don't they also have a, I thought it said appeal to a court?
Yes, they do.
So is that either or is that to you and then to the court?
To me and then to the court.
Is would that, would that be a state court?
Yes.
Well, I just, let me say, because I guess my sense is that, you know, that the more we look at this, the more it's clear that it's not simple to write administrative rules. It's simple to say, which is, that we need to reform the world of big money in elections and that we need some different systems. As we put the system in place, it's clearly difficult to anticipate the questions that are going to come up. And I think at the end of the day, the council is best in this situation to essentially assume based on the work to date that we're not going to be able to write a rule that correctly interacts everything that might happen, particularly when you then get into ambiguities between us and state rules on reporting, which is one of the situations that's in play right now. And so I think the best thing to do is to continue to revise the rules, make as strong a system as we can where everything is predictable, and then say if something happens outside of those bounds, the auditor decides it. You know, and the auditor is somebody who is elected to use judgment just like the city council is. And, you know, when we have a land use case and it's gray, it's well believed that we should, not just that we can, but that we should use some intent in interpreting our code. And whereas that is frowned upon by somebody who's issuing the permit, you know, to say, okay, if we can actually say in a majority's judgment, the intent of this code was to do X, you know, even if you read it literally, it might be just slightly off X. And I think the more we can nail everything down, the better. But I just think from what I've seen so far, it appears inevitable that there will be electoral situations that are both inadvertent and contrived. And I think the best thing for us to do is to say there's an elections officer who will decide that.
Yes,
the past seem to be willing to wear that mantle. So.
The political action committees are required to report when they make expenditures on behalf of candidates. So we, under state law as well as our own rules, so to the degree that we have some quantity of expenditure and it's declared to be in favor of a candidate, we have some objective basis to start from. The idea about the appeals is more around, you know, there were scenarios that came up where someone would do something that looked like it was benefiting a candidate, but in truth it wasn't. So those were the kinds of situations where there are some subjective, you know, strategies going on where we, you know, I would likely want to consult with the Citizen Campaign Commission just in those areas to get a sense from them and being able to basically make a call on something. Most of these are going to be, you know, issues that go over and above what we're normally dealing with in terms of campaign spending. So, you know, I can't anticipate all the different variations that people could dream up, and we recognize that these scenarios don't cover all of them. And we also recognize that this is a system where money wants to get in. And we're trying to keep the money out, or at least to keep it so that it's equitable among the participants and doesn't overwhelm any one candidate or any that it's really more around giving everyone a level playing field. So that's the struggle we have with this, is there are many ways that money can get in there. And We anticipate that we'll be coming back and adding more independent expenditure scenarios in the future, because as we think of them, we will add, you know, those, or at least check to make sure our code addresses them, and if it doesn't, we'll come back with revisions.
So if a looking at your example, if the spending favors a publicly funded candidate, then the threshold is raised for the non-participating.
Right.
What if the expenditure is clearly against the non-participating candidate, but not necessarily attributable to benefiting one of the publicly funded candidates? In other words, it's a hit campaign against that non-participating candidate.
Then the threshold would be raised for that candidate. I mean, it's not presumed
that it necessarily benefits the publicly funded candidate. You're just saying it's strictly against the non-participating candidate, that threshold gets it.
I think that does benefit.
Right. Okay. Right. We've.
But you don't have to make a finding of a particular publicly funded candidate benefit from that.
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, if it's against a publicly funded candidate, then they would get matching. The other publicly, if there were more than one in the primary, they wouldn't get matching also. If it's against a non-participating candidate, then that non-participating candidate would have the ability to raise money to the extent of that expenditure against him or her to kind of compensate for that and not trigger matching funds for participating candidates.
Does this cover the issue that was raised at one point about candidates shifting from one position, a city commissioner position, to another city commissioner position?
At this point in the code, they have to start over again. And, I mean, that's one of the things, in terms of special elections, that was one of the considerations that the commission looked at but decided in this case to hold off on it. And they will be going back to working on code for special elections at the next meeting.
Is the rewritten code consistent with state election laws?
Yes, we lay over state elections laws, but the time frame and is narrower in terms of the control we hold over candidates before and after. There are state election reporting laws. Let me say that apply to everyone all the time. We actually have more stringent reporting requirements once someone gets into our system. Excuse me, and other penalties that far exceed anything the state would impose if they break our rules. So those are the kinds of things that are different than ours, but we do lay over state reporting rules. The state requires reporting every 30 days. We require it within 2 weeks. So we have a much more timely reporting, and it actually shortens to 7 days as we get closer to the election date.
Having read the document, it's not an easy read.
It's not an easy.
How are you going to advise or educate not only the candidates who qualify, but those who are not accepting public funds so that everybody understands the ground rules, because they will apply from the date that the ordinance is passed?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that what the commission recommended was that we incorporate the scenarios and the narratives in the rules that are provided. So, and then we provide training to all the candidates, and training is available to the non-participating candidates as well. So to the degree that we can walk through those issues, and especially when something comes up, you know, an independent expenditure is made, we can sit down with them and explain where in the code, what we're applying, and why. But certainly these will all be available to the public on our website as well, so they can understand if they are a PAC, what the consequences might be if they spend money on behalf of a particular candidate for a city race.
So they will be specifically advised of that, not just that it's available, but they will be notified of this change?
Yes.
Okay. What is the time period under which the independent expenditure rules exist?
Well,
is it 60 days before the election? Is it? They exist?
No. Once a candidate gets certified, then that would come into play for them in terms of if they are benefiting or harmed in some way by a negative one against them. If there's two non-participating candidates, then the rules wouldn't, you know, for a race, then the rules wouldn't apply at all. So
if there is a participating and a non-participating, as soon as the participating is certified.
Right.
So the rules would instantly carry over to a runoff as well, then.
And that's correct.
Same scenario, the whole duration of the runoff.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Does the pool of monies, Are they for each position or for all of the candidates?
For each position.
Each position. So, for instance, the pool remains at $150,000 in the primary for that one position. And if there are five people in that position, they would not get $150,000 each. They would divvy up that $150,000. Is that
That's correct.
Yeah. Same for the mayor's race.
Exactly.
And in the general.
That's correct.
Further questions?
Good job. I mean, I commend you and the commission for taking on this work, and I think it is going to be something that's, you know, will have to be revisited as we anticipate more examples. But I think this is a good, solid framework under which to get this problem into the code. So thanks.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, this is also in part response to what is some incredibly devious thinking that people have done hypothetically on the various blogs and columns throughout the city. Because, I mean, I think there's, you know, a sense of, you know, what if somebody does this, what if somebody does that. And I would just point out that before this system, the way they did that was to raise a couple hundred thousand dollars and just hit the airwaves. I mean, what if somebody hits somebody with a scurrilous attack is not a new question in politics. In fact, it's, you know, commonplace. And what this does is, you know, now the question is, well, how would a system that, in my opinion, has done two things already? One is majorly lowered the amount of money that's being spent on these races. There's no major candidate in any race that hasn't voluntarily capped their funds at, I would say, a third of what they would have raised before this started. You know, you see a mayor's race capping at 200 in 1990 non-inflated dollars. Earl and Dreher were each over a million. You know, and that's how many years ago that was, but quite a few, and at least money has probably doubled since then. So the money's come way down in all of the races, and I'm actually hearing the non-publicly funded candidates tell me that's terrific because they can go about it a different way. And then in the race for the open seat, you have five candidates who are all viable. We can debate whether or not they would have been viable under the old system. That's an interesting debate. What I can tell you is that in modern history, there's never been more than three that were considered viable, and that's a stretch as well. And so there's no doubt that we have more viable candidates running under this system than we've ever had. And actually, in that race, there's six viable candidates, five of who've qualified, and one Representative Mike Fahey, who I think everybody would take very seriously in this race, who chose not to get in. So, you know, we have way more candidates running, way less money being spent, and way more devious thinking. But I wouldn't say this devious thinking anywhere is near what happens with swift boats and everything else. And the fact that we're actually thinking how to counteract it ahead of time and thereby maybe dissuade people from doing it is also a step in the right direction. Although I think, as you kind of mentioned, I think we all know that money, and particularly attempting to be untraced money, will always flow into politics. I think we just have a better chance of stopping that flow or slowing it down or daylighting it or whatever you want to say in our system, perhaps, than some others. So thank you, Auditor Blackmer.
Is there any objection to holding this over till next week?
Do you want to move that amendment, Gary?
Oh, could you accept the amended report? I had made some corrections to the report from what you originally were distributed last week, and I think
they got them yesterday.
You got them yesterday in your packet. So,
moving the amendments?
Yeah, to the accept the amended report.
Would that then apply to next week's vote by voting with just three people today?
Since this is a report that's accompanying the ordinance and it's there's no changes to the ordinance itself, if you just accept the amended report to accompany the ordinance, that'll suffice. It will move forward with the ordinance as it goes to a vote next week. You don't have the votes this week to adopt this emergency ordinance.
Do I hear a motion to accept the amendment?
I would move to accept the amended report.
Second.
Call the vote.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
Thank you.
This will be set over for a vote till next Wednesday at what time?
It'll be on the 9:30 regular agenda.